nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, we've been talking about Boolean optimization, right? There is one final footnote that I'd like to mention before we finish that topic and move on to the next topic. So, and that relates to the issue of cyclic combinational circuits. Conventionally, the thought process is that combinational circuits, which do not have any state, in other words, their outputs depend only on the present input and not on any of the history of inputs. Structurally, the definition of combinational circuits is a functional definition, right? Functionally, the output of the circuit should depend only on the current input. However, conventional thinking has been that if you look at combinational circuits from a structural perspective, if you look at their connectivity of the gates or transistors, the conventional thinking is that combinational circuits have to be acyclic. In other words, if you think of them as a Boolean network, you cannot actually have any cycles, or as a network of gates, you cannot have any structural cycles. That was the conventional thinking, and I'm sure that is how most of you have been taught in your undergraduate courses. In fact, when you talk about how you design a latch or a flip-flop, you take a couple of gates and add a feedback loop, and that makes it sequential, right? So conventionally, the thought process has been that acyclic, combinational, cyclic, sequential. However, in reality, that is not necessarily true. Okay. For a long time, people thought that combinational circuits have to be acyclic, but in reality, it turns out that the notion of combinational, the property of being combinational is a functional property, as I said. A circuit is combinational if it does not have any memory. In other words, the outputs of the circuit depend only on the current values of inputs and not on any of the history of inputs. The notion that combinational circuits cannot contain structural cycles was much relatively recently shown to be a misconception. Okay. In fact, more importantly, it turns out that it is sometimes important for combinational circuits to contain cycles. If you want to realize the smallest implementation of some class of functions, the smallest combinational realizations of these functions actually have structural cycles in them. Okay. Let's look at an example. Let me give you first a conceptual example, and then we'll look at an example in terms of a Boolean network, right? So conceptually, if you would like to implement a function which is of this form, and I'm going to describe the function, you know, from a behavioral perspective. So if some condition C, then suppose you would like to say that Y, which is the output of your circuit, equals F of G of X. Okay. So in other words, X is the input of your circuit. You compute function G, take the output of function G, and then give it to F, if C is true. So the inputs to the circuit are C and X, and the output is Y. Okay. So structurally, you can think of your circuit as taking condition C, X, and the output is Y. Okay. And the functionality of the circuit is as follows. If C is true, C is a single bit, X could be, you know, one or any number of bits, it doesn't matter. If C, Y equals F of G of X, else Y equals G of F of X. So again, I'm using functions G and F, but only in the opposite order. Okay. And that's it. This is the function I wish to realize. This is not just a single function, but a family of functions, because I can pick any function for F, I can pick any function for G, and you can come up with a family of functions of this nature. It doesn't matter what F is and what G is. F and G can be any function themselves. Okay. So if this is the function, if overall circuit that I would wish to realize a minimum implementation of this functionality. Okay. So what is the simplest way you would think of doing it? Well, one way you could, the straightforward way to approach this is to say that I have a copy of Y, a circuit that implements Y, and I'm going to feed X to it, right? And then, a copy of G, and I'm going to feed X to it, and take the output of G and feed it to a block that implements F. Similarly, I also have another copy of F that takes X directly to compute F of X, take its output, give it to a G block, right? And based on the condition C, I need to pick one or the other. So that looks like, what does that look like? What do you need here? a multiplexer, right? Based on the condition C, if C is 1, I want f of g of x. If C is 0, I want g of f of x, and this is my output y, right? So this is the circuit, the structural, the straightforward realization of this. How many copies of f and g each do you need? 2, right? So this realization of the circuit, of this function, requires 2 copies of f and 2 copies of g. What if I asked you, can you do it in 1 copy of f and 1 copy of g? This is still a combinational circuit. Given x, it has only 2 inputs. Given x and given c, the value of y is determined. I don't need to know the previous values of x or c. Only the current values matter. So this function is inherently combinational, assuming that g and f are combinational. So what if I asked you to realize this function, and this is an acyclic circuit, right? There are no structural cycles here. You have, you know, an acyclic flow of electrical signals from x and c to y. So this is fine. But what if I asked you, can you realize the same function with 1 copy of f and 1 copy of g? Right? Do you think it can be done? Okay, let's try to go with that thought. So I'm going to erase this and now try to come up with another implementation, a smaller implementation, right? I don't want to have 2 copies of f, 2 copies of g. I'd like to have 1 copy of each. So let's see if we are able to do that. So I'm going to put down my copy of f and copy of g. Okay, now the input of f, if c is true, has to come from the output of g. But if c is false, it has to come directly from x. So the input of this, since I have only 1 copy of f, it needs to perform both these f's, functionally need to be mapped to the same structural copy of f. The input has to come from 2 different places. How do you select that? You need a multiplexer, right? So one of these cases is going to be x, and the other is going to be g. So when c is true, you come from g. When c is false, you get it from x. That's c there. Okay. Similarly, you need a multiplexer in front of g as well. When c is true, the input of g comes from x directly. When c is false, the input comes from output of f. Okay. This is just a wire crossing. There's no electrical connection there. Okay. So now you've got these computations covered, but you still need to produce y, right? Y, if c is true, comes from the output of f. If c is false, y comes from the output of g. So all that you need to do is take the outputs of f and g again to a multiplexer, and that gives you y. So the zero case should be g, and the one case should be f. That is c again. This is y. Okay? So this is a different realization of the same function. However, now I've used only 1 copy of f and 1 copy of g. Of course, I've added a couple of multiplexers, but you can choose f and g such that they are much larger than multiplexers. So this is still the smaller realization compared to the one we had before. However, if you look at this realization, structurally, is it acyclic? No. Why is it? It has a cycle. What is the cycle? If you start tracing, let's say from this point, you can trace through f, go to the input of g, come out from the output of g, and trace back to the input of f. So that's a structural cycle, right? Is this circuit combinational? In other words, if I apply inputs at x and c, will the output at y automatically settle to some value, independent of the history of the inputs? Yes, it is combinational. What happens here is that depending on whether c is 0 or 1, if you look at the structural cycle goes through these 2 multiplexers, right? If c is 1, the cycle is broken at this multiplexer because the other input of the multiplexer is being selected. Logically, the cycle is broken. The input of the multiplexer that is coming from the cyclic path is not selected. Similarly, if C is zero, the cycle is broken at this multiplexer from a logical point of view. So even though structurally this circuit is cyclic, from a functional point of view, no matter, and C can only be 0 or 1, no matter which value C takes, you're going to be breaking the cycle at one of the multiplexers. And therefore, in practice, if you look at the paths, the electrical paths that can actually propagate signals from X and C to the output, they actually will end up being acyclic. Okay? Because the cycle gets disabled, functionally disabled. Okay? So, put differently, the structural cyclic path is actually a false path. Right? We haven't talked about timing analysis yet. We will come back to that and we'll more rigorously define what a false path is. But for now, you can think of a false path as a path, structural path that exists in the circuit, but that's never activated. Okay? So, this is one example of a class of circuits, because F and G can be anything, of a class of circuits where the minimal implementation is cyclic. Let's look at an example with actual Boolean functions. So here's an example of, suppose you're trying to compute these three functions together. You're trying to compute F1, F2, and F3. They are functions of three input variables, X1, X2, and X3. And these are the Boolean expressions for F1, F2, and F3. Okay, if you wanted to realize, is this already minimal? Probably is. I don't think there's anything you can really share. But if you would like to further share logic among these functions and have a smaller implementation, so let's count the number of literals you have in the original implementation. This is acyclic, right? So this, if you drew this out as a Boolean network, you'll have three nodes, each for F1, F2, and F3. Each of them takes a common set of inputs and produces separate outputs. So there is no cycles in this implementation. How many literals do you need for this one? For the original implementation? 6 for F1, right? 7 for F2, and 7 for F3. So that's a total of 20 literals, right? It turns out that the minimum implementation for this function requires fewer literals, fewer than 20. So here's one possible implementation, and I'll leave it to you as a homework exercise to verify by applying all values of X1, X2, and X3, that this functionally, the outputs F1, F2, and F3 are the same as the expressions above. Okay? But take it from me for granted for now that this is functionally equivalent to that circuit, to that set of expressions up there. But this circuit actually contains cycles. So here, what we've done is we've taken F1 and expressed F1 in terms of F3. Similarly, F3 is expressed in terms of F2. F2 is expressed in terms of F1. So because of this cascaded dependencies, you actually introduce a structural cycle. Okay. Is this combinational? Well, it turns out that yes, this is again a combinational circuit. And again, you can, like we argued, that the one of these two multiplexers disables the cycle. We can argue that if you look at the side inputs so the cycle consists of the dependency from F1 to F2, F2 to F3, and F3 to F1. If you look at these two dependencies, the dependency from F3 to F1 and the dependency from F1 to F2, these are two of the edges on the cyclic path, you will see that one of these two will always be disabled. Because if you consider the case where X1 equals 1, X1 is one of the inputs to this expression. It can take only two possible values. If it takes the value 1, X1 prime is going to be 0, and the value of F3 doesn't matter anymore. It gets killed at this point. Similarly, if x1 is 0, on the other hand, the value of f1 gets killed here because you're adding it with x1 here. So no matter what value x1 takes, the cycle is going to be disabled either at this edge or at this edge. And therefore, this still remains a combinational circuit. However, it has a structural cycle in it. Okay. The first publication to report, the first person to discover the fact that certain classes of circuits, such as this one, necessarily have to be cyclic if you are looking for the minimum implementation, was William Codd's. And, you know, this was, although Boolean logic can, logic circuit design go way back, as we've seen. The notion that combinational circuits can be cyclic and, in fact, need to be cyclic sometimes was only discovered in 1970. Okay, why are we talking about cyclic combinational circuits now? Right? What is the context? We're talking about Boolean optimization. How can these cyclic combinational circuits, how can these cycles arise during synthesis? Right. Remember, we talked about Boolean optimization using don't cares, where you're trying to do Boolean division of one node by all the other nodes in the network. What you do is you compute the satisfiability don't cares and observability don't cares, SDC and ODCs, which are in terms of all the variables in the network. Then you try to do two-level optimization of the node under interest with that entire don't care space as the don't cares for that node itself. When you do that, and especially when you allow variables in the transitive fan-out of a node to appear in its don't care set, then there is a possibility that such cycles can be introduced. This is precisely why we said, when we talked about this optimization, that we will not use variables in the transitive fan-out. Okay. But why place that arbitrary constraint? Now that you realize that some circuits, actually, you will get minimal implementations only by allowing that, what if you remove that constraint? Well, the reason this constraint has been there traditionally in practice is because most design automation tools and algorithms in those tools don't really know how to handle cyclic structures. They're all optimized for the case where the circuit is acyclic. Okay. Circuit is acyclic, timing analysis becomes much easier, automatic test pattern generation is easier. A lot of the steps that are performed in design automation the algorithms become much easier for acyclic structures. You take advantage of the fact that the circuit is acyclic. So the tools, in fact, most commercial tools will actually give you errors. They will break. So if you look at logic synthesis tools, what they probably will do is, if you give them a circuit that is cyclic like this as the input, they'll say this has a cycle, and for the purpose of analysis, I'm going to be cutting one of these edges, and I'll assume that this edge doesn't exist. Of course, when they optimize the circuit and finally write it out, they'll put that edge back. But if you do that, then it is difficult to perform accurate analysis of the circuit because they would not really analyze the circuit to figure out, in this case, the edge that breaks the cycle is actually different depending on whether C is 0 or C is 1. So they would just structurally pick one of the wires in the circuit and break it and assume that, for example, they might do this and assume that this is a new input to the circuit and this is a new output of the circuit and optimize that acyclic circuit. And after all, synthesis then put this whole thing back together. But that's not going to be accurate because the time, for example, when you try to analyze the clock period of the circuit, when you do that, you'll get a conservative estimate. Okay. It turns out that algorithms in the design automation tools can actually be enhanced to work with cycles at the cost of some increase in complexity, a modest slowdown in the runtime of the tools. You can actually enhance these tools to work with cyclic circuits. And there was some research more recently that actually showed in the mid-90s, that showed that you can actually, given a cyclic structure like this, you can analyze it and tell, first of all, whether it's combinational or not, because you want to make sure that it's indeed combinational. Your cycle has not introduced state into the circuit. You can also try to analyze the circuit for timing, for example. You can figure out what should be the clock period. How fast do you clock this circuit? Normally, the clock period is determined by the longest path from the inputs to the output or between flip-flops. When you have cycles, how many times do you go around the cycle? Do you keep going around it? Right? Which path do you talk about? Right? So the timing analysis problem becomes more complex, but it can actually be solved. So the paper by Malik actually addresses both the functional and timing analysis. There's a paper shortly following that talked about test generation. How do you generate manufacturing tests for such structures? And more recently, this is a paper that actually won the best paper award at the Design Automation Conference, where they actually showed how you could remove that constraint of when you do don't care based optimization, not including the transitive fan out variables. Remember, you don't want to arbitrarily allow all possible cycles. Some cycles that result, if you remove this constraint of variables in the transitive fan out cannot appear in the don't care set, if you just completely ignore it, then sometimes you will actually get sequential circuits, like the trivial case we talked about where a node feeds itself. You know, you still don't want that case, right? You want some cases, but you don't want other cases. So you need to selectively relax those constraints, not always. So this paper talks about how you can do that, and how you can systematically synthesize, starting with functional specifications, you can systematically do logic synthesis, which will result in cyclic combinational circuits. And they reported that across a wide range of benchmarks, they were able to get 5 to 10% area improvements or reduction in number of literals by doing this. It might not seem like a lot, but on top of an already optimized process, it is actually a significant amount. And interesting note is that, you know, almost 20 years back to the date, I was taking a very similar class like you're all doing now. And this paper started off as my course project in design automation. So hopefully, you know, some of you also will go on to have, it was a fun experience. Hopefully some of you will also go on to have similarly productive experiences. Okay, so with that interesting side note, let's step back and summarize, right? So this brings us to the end of the discussion on technology-independent synthesis. So we're talking about multi-level synthesis. We said there's going to be two stages. Technology-independent, where you don't consider any specific implementation technology or cell library, and you just optimize the circuit as a network of Boolean functions. So we use the Boolean network model. We proposed the algebraic optimizations by optimizing the circuit, purely viewing those Boolean expressions inside the nodes as algebraic expressions. And then we've also talked about Boolean optimizations using satisfiability and observability don't cares. Okay. So now we will start a new topic today, which is the topic of technology mapping. Actually, before we go to technology mapping, let's briefly look at in this lecture. Let's briefly look at how the different steps that we have proposed in technology independent optimization are actually implemented in practice in some of the tools. So for this purpose, we will be looking at the research tools, MIS and SIS from UC Berkeley, which implement many of the techniques that we have talked about. Okay. So in practice, how are all these concepts of algebraic optimization and Boolean optimization implemented in synthesis tools? So the approach that the developers of these tools, MIS and SIS, took was that there's a number of these optimization steps, such as factorization, extraction of nodes, collapsing nodes, Boolean optimization using don't cares. These are all individual optimization steps. However, the overall problem of how to choose an appropriate sequence of these steps to completely optimize a circuit is a very, very challenging problem. It's a very difficult problem. So the approach that they took, the developers of these tools took, was that we will expose these optimization steps to the end users as commands that they can call. And users of these tools need to write scripts, which are user-specified recipes or sequences of these optimization steps that will be performed on a given circuit. And you can, the reason this is a useful strategy in practice is because different circuits tend to have, for example, control logic versus data path logic tends to be very different in terms of which of these optimizations they are actually amenable to. Okay. So by leaving these steps to the user, on the one hand, of course, you are increasing the complexity of, you know, using the tool. But on the other hand, you're giving the user greater control of what sequence of optimization steps to try out. And, you know, as a user, you can always try out different series of optimization steps and see if it helps improve your circuit or not. So the choice that they made was to go ahead and use these scripts, expose the commands, the optimization steps as commands that a user could call, and user's job is to write a script. Of course, there are some standard scripts that they provide that you can reuse. And what I'll be doing is going through one example of such a script, happens to be called script.rugged, which, as you can see, invokes a series of commands in SIS in order to optimize combinational circuits. So all of this corresponds to technology independent optimization, all of these commands that we have talked about. Okay. Technology mapping is separate. So this is a script for technology independent optimization. And what we'll do is we'll essentially walk through this synthesis script by looking at each of the commands and trying to map these commands to some of the concepts that we've talked about. Okay. So you can see that the commands in the script are grouped into a few different sections or segments. I've intentionally kind of separated them out and grouped the related commands with each other. And we'll come back and talk about why this kind of grouping makes sense. But we'll look at examples of the commands. First, let's start with the command that appears four times, the sweep command. This is a very simple cleanup command, which basically removes all the nodes in your Boolean network. Remember, each of these commands does something to a Boolean network. So before you run such a script, you would read in your circuit description, right? And you would have constructed your initial Boolean network. So each of these commands starts off with a Boolean network, and it changes it in some sense. But at the end of the command, you still have hopefully more optimized Boolean network, right? So with that context, what does the sweep command do? It removes all the nodes in your network with that implement a constant function, or nodes which have only one input. So what are nodes which have only one input? How many Boolean functions can you have with just one input? Two, right? So either a buffer or an inverter, or the constant functions, of course. So basically what this thing does is that it cleans up such nodes, and if your original network, the way you've written your circuit, already has such redundancies or such nodes, of course they get cleaned away. But more importantly, if your other optimization steps, intermediate optimization steps, produce such nodes, they get cleaned away by the sweep command. Okay, so this is a very straightforward command. Here's an example of a transcript of executing this command in sys. Like I said, you first need a Boolean network to be able to run this command. So you might be reading in, for example, one of the formats that sys uses to, and you will be performing some hands-on exercises with sys in two homeworks from now, where you will actually go through this. So all of this hopefully will become more familiar, and this should help you understand that homework better. But one of the formats that sys uses as input or supports for you to specify your circuit is the equation format. You might remember this from Logic Friday that I demonstrated in class. So you just specify the Boolean network by enumerating the equations of each of the nodes. So F equals A, G equals F, H equals F, Q equals A plus A prime. So this is a simple circuit that I've constructed. And suppose this is in the file sweep.eqn. The first command in sys is you read the equation and give it the parameter of the file name. At any point in sys, you can actually print out the network. If you just say print, it's going to print out the network by essentially printing out the Boolean expressions inside each of the nodes. Okay. So this is a straightforward correspondence, one-to-one correspondence with your equation file. Once you execute sweep and then print again, you see what happens here, right? The node F equals A gets eliminated because it's a single input node. However, the nodes G and H do not get eliminated because these are primary outputs. These are still needed. You cannot get rid of them. You need some node for the primary output. Also, you see that, you know, even though A plus A prime is one, sweep is a very straightforward command, it will not be able to perform this optimization. There are other commands that will perform that optimization, but the final circuit that will result is, it will, you'll basically remove the node F. Okay. Moving on. The next command is the eliminate command. And this command is called with a parameter, which is basically a threshold. And we'll see in a minute what that threshold means. But what this command does is that it eliminates from the network all nodes whose value is less than or equal to the threshold that you have specified. How does it eliminate them? By taking them and substituting them into all their fanouts. So one node in the network, its output is used as a literal in some other nodes in the network. What this command does is that certain nodes which satisfy the criterion, value less than or equal to threshold, are identified. And then each of those is substituted into all the other nodes where its output appears as literals. Value is essentially the same as the notion of value we talked about when we discussed factoring and extraction. Right? That is, value represents the value of a node is the number of literals saved by keeping the node. Okay, just note how it is defined. It's pretty straightforward. But a positive value means that keeping the node in the network without collapsing it, keeping it, saves you literals. So collapsing will increase the literals. Then the node has a positive value. Okay. So note that what we are doing here is eliminate minus one in a couple of cases, and eliminate five here, and then again an eliminate minus one here. There is an option to approximate the number of literal, the value by the number of times a node appears in the factored form of its fanouts, you know, we won't, I'll let you, when you actually come to the homework where you run sys, you'll be looking at the manual pages, the help pages for each of these commands. You'll be able to understand this better. So we'll gloss over this detail for a second, but the example should make it clear. So if you started off with a network as shown here, where you have two nodes, eliminate minus one will result in the network shown here with only one node, because if you look at the value, so value is the difference between the literals before and after, right? So before you have four literals, after you have three literals. So the value of this node is minus one, right? Because you actually have a change in literals of minus one from the before to the after. So if you do an eliminate minus one, you would eliminate the node f. On the other hand, if you do an eliminate 5 and started off with a network like this, then if you count the number of literals here, you see that you have 3 plus 2, 5, 8, 11, and 14 literals, right? Before and after, how many literals do you have? 4 and 5, 9, 14, 19 literals. So the node f here has a value of 5, because keeping it saves you 5 literals as opposed to collapsing it. And all nodes with a value of less than equal to 5, so if a node has a value 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, or a negative value, 0 or a negative value, all such nodes will be identified and collapsed into the subsequent nodes. Okay. Why would you want to do this? Multiple reasons, but why would you want to do this? It gives you different opportunities for extraction. So this is one common sub-expression across these nodes. Maybe there's a bigger common sub-expression that you can identify by collapsing. So this is almost like the expand phase in Espresso for hill climbing. That's one possibility. The other reason you would do it is because these more complex expressions, now you can run Espresso on these more complex expressions. And then this may get simplified. So there may be some redundancies that are not clear here. But when you actually substitute the node in to create this larger expressions, the optimization of simplification of these nodes has a greater scope for optimization. Okay. So that's another reason you might want to do this. So we've looked at sweep and eliminate. Let's look at the simplify command. So this command basically runs Espresso on the SOP expression for each node using a subset of the implicit don't cares. Okay. So, what subset, I'll leave that detail off now. You can look at the man pages for sys and understand exactly how it does it. But it basically does a fast computation of don't cares. It doesn't compute all the don't cares. It computes a fast, some subset of the don't cares and simplifies, runs Espresso on each node. Minus M no comp means, you know, it's this option actually just gets passed on to Espresso. If you remember the Espresso algorithm, the first step in Espresso is actually to compute the offset. And it turns out that that actually can take a long time. And so the Espresso has a way of proceeding without computing the full offset. And this minus M no comp is just a option to Espresso. There are multiple options, other options to this simplify command that will control how the don't cares get computed. The default uses some subset of the transitive fan-in of the node. And there's another command which is very much like simplify. It's called full simplify. The only difference is that in full simplify, you will compute the entire set of don't cares. So full simplify, you should expect to be slower. So as you can see, it's just done once towards at the end of the script. Okay, you do simplify a couple of times, but full simplify only once at the end. Here's two examples of simplify. The previous example where we had g equals a plus a prime, of course, you know, simplify should convert that to a 1. Now following this, if you do a sweep, this node should get eliminated, right? So that's why you have this simplify followed by a sweep. Here, the sweep. Similarly, you know, you have this other example, slightly more complex example, where again the simplification of this expression leads to a fewer literals. Moving on. Now, so we've talked about Boolean optimization. Now let's talk about a couple of algebraic optimization steps. So one of these algebraic optimizations is known as, is called resub. What this command does is that it looks at each node in the network and tries to substitute it into the other nodes of the network. In other words, it looks at the expression computed by this node and says, is this a sub-expression of the expression of any of the other nodes? So can I take the output of this node directly and use it to save literals in some other nodes? Okay. And what, in addition to the node's output, it also explores using complement of the node's output. Okay. And the minus A option to resub asks it to use algebraic division as opposed to Boolean division. Okay. And resub, it doesn't do this just to one node. It keeps doing this until, you know, to as many nodes as possible until the literal count of the network improves. So this is actually a series of steps. But all of them are the same. They try to take a node, substitute its output in other nodes, either in the positive form or in the complemented form. So here's an example. Start off with this network with three nodes. If you try to substitute F into the other nodes, you'll see that you can do that. And this is what happens. On the other hand, if you try to substitute G into F or H into F, that's not possible. So the only way that works in this case is substituting F into G and H. Here's another example where H is a little different, but in this case, it turns out that you can use F in the complemented form. So in a sense, what this does is it's a little bit more than algebraic substitution. It computes the complement expression of this expression, and it uses both of those expressions and goes and tries to see where it can substitute them. So that's what resub does. So this certainly, you know, uses algebraic division, right, in order to identify where the node can be substituted. The last one that we look at is fx. This command finds all single cube and double cube divisors of all common divisors of all the nodes in the network. And it extracts the best common factor or common divisor as a new node. Okay. So this is exactly when we talked about, you know, trying to find single cube divisors, multi cube divisors and trying to extract them. This is where that gets implemented. Okay. And you can see it's done only once because it's a little more expensive step. Right. So, but, there is a little bit of a twist here. When we talked about computation of single and multi cube divisors, we didn't restrict ourselves to only double cube. It turns out that subsequent to that initial research on kernels and co-kernels, they realized that from a practical point of view, rather than looking at arbitrary multi-cube devices, there are much faster algorithms to identify only double cube devices if you're only interested in that. In addition, empirically, researchers also found that by repeatedly extracting double cube devices, you can get most of the benefits in terms of literal savings that you can get by extracting these larger divisors. So you're still extracting large divisors, except you're extracting two cubes at a time. And by doing it over a larger number of steps, you essentially achieve the same end result. Okay? But it's much faster in practice. So that's the reason why FX implements a slightly different algorithm than what we talked about in class, a faster version of what we talked about to extract only single cube and double cube divisors. Usually, FX is immediately followed by a resub, because once you identify divisors and extract it as a separate node, now you want to substitute it wherever applicable, and you also want to substitute its complement wherever applicable. So immediately, you follow it with a resub. There's a couple of other commands, GCX and GKX, which implement exactly what we talked about in class. So GCX extracts all possible single-cube divisors using co-kernels, and GKX identifies all possible kernels and all possible multi-cube divisors. So originally, when SIS was originally developed, instead of FX, they were using GCX and GKX. Later on, they realized that if you restrict yourself here to only two cube divisors, it turns out that there's a much faster algorithm that was proposed later, and that was implemented in SIS, and that's what FX is. Okay. But the concepts are essentially the same. So here's an example of FX. If you have these three nodes initially, turns out that the largest double cube divisor you can extract is AB plus C. And you can do that across these two nodes. FX creates new nodes by extracting these common factors. What resub does is that it looks at these common factors and their complements and tries to substitute it everywhere else in the network. So now we've discussed each and every one of these commands individually, right? So we know what each of these commands does. Now let's try to take a big picture view of this entire synthesis script. Let's see what is going on here, right? I mean, there has to be some method or meaning to this sequence of steps. Okay. So the strategy that is followed in the rugged script is one of a staged optimization. So there are four phases of optimization of the Boolean network, starting from simpler optimization to more complex optimization. Okay. So in terms of runtime, you should expect that this should be the fastest, followed by this, and followed by the last one. If you look at what is happening here, what you're really doing is a sweep, which is just getting rid of these constant and single input nodes, eliminate minus one, which is taking nodes that really do not save any literals and substituting them, collapsing them into their fanouts, and then performing simplification of the expressions in the nodes using a fast computation of subset of node pairs. And then, so this is, you can think of this as a simple cleanup of your initial network, followed by the first round of easy factoring, because you're doing resub. Remember, the eliminate here is a little more aggressive. You're looking at nodes that actually save literals, but still collapsing them, save up to five literals and still collapsing them into their fanouts, so that the subsequent simplify step has a little more opportunity compared to the simplify step here, which would not have, you know, seen as much opportunity. The simplify step here will be looking at a network where potentially more collapsing has occurred. So the expressions are a little more complex. So hopefully Espresso has more scope for optimization. And then you're also doing the resub here, right? And this is, you can think of this as the aggressive, more aggressive algebraic optimization phase, where you're doing more aggressive factoring by identifying common divisors, extracting them and then resubstituting them. And again, just using sweep as a cleanup after you're done, because some new trivial nodes may have been introduced in that process. And finally, you're optimizing the expressions within each node using a full set of don't care. So this is where Boolean optimization is coming in here. Okay, so this script is combining algebraic and Boolean optimization by, you know, performing simple cleanup, two rounds of algebraic optimization, and then one final round of Boolean optimization. So algebraic, of course, the algebraic model is used for extracting factors and substitution. The Boolean optimization is used for node simplification here. Okay, so any questions about how the script works, or you know, the general approach of exposing these commands? It might seem a little complex, but you know, in practice, there's various, you know, scripts that work well in practice that kind of get collected into a library, and then, you know, as a user, you can just reuse those scripts. So, you know, you don't necessarily have to dig into these details, but you have the option of doing it. So you learn more about sys when you play with it, you know, in the homework. So let's move on for now. So this brings us now to the end of the tech, truly brings us to the end of the technology independent part of multi-level synthesis. So in technology independent optimizations, we talked about the model that you're using for the circuit, the Boolean network model. We talked about the different operations, the transformations that you can perform on this, on a Boolean network, such as, you know, extraction of nodes, substitution, elimination, and so on. We talked about the algebraic model for factoring. Factoring is a common step involved in most of these operations. So we've talked about algebraic model for factoring using kernels and co-kernels, efficient algorithms for doing that using zero and matrices. And then we moved on to talk about Boolean optimization using don't cares. And we covered how all of these things fit into actual commands or techniques implemented in MIS and SIS. So next, what we'll be doing is talk about technology mapping. So once you've done all of this technology independent optimization, you have an optimized Boolean network. How do you take it and realize it in an efficient way for a given cell library or for a given technology? Okay. Here are some papers that I'll post on Blackboard. The material in the first two, three papers was largely covered. This is Rick Rural's PhD thesis, which is already posted on Blackboard. The first two papers is largely covered in terms of what we taught in class, what we looked at in class. This is the paper that I referred to that showed that it's sufficient to only look at double cube divisors. From a actual quality, if you only extract double cube divisors, the end quality of the circuits, the literal count ends up being same or almost the same, either virtually identical to kernel-based factoring, where you're looking at arbitrarily sized multi-cube divisors, but the algorithms here are about 10 times faster in practice. So the runtime of your synthesis is going to be much faster, and you get the same quality. So it's actually a very good trade-off, and this is what is implemented in the command fx that we talked about. So I'll post this paper for your reference, as well as the top two. Okay, for the rest of the class, let's talk about technology mapping. So here you're going from this Boolean network to real gates or real cells from your cell library. So this is the top level flow of any logic synthesis tool. You have your initial logic network that you read in from the initial specification from the user, and then perform the technology independent optimizations we've talked about. And then in the technology mapping phase, you need the cell library. You need to know the specific technology in which you're going to be implementing the circuit. Technology mapping works quite differently based on the target implementation technology. If you're trying to synthesize for an FPGA versus for a cell-based library versus for a gate array, you know, this library is going to look very different. Okay? So standard cells versus FPGA versus gate arrays, you know, the way you represent the library, the way technology mapping works is going to be very different, but technology independent optimization is actually common to all three. So that's one good reason to separate things out in this way, because the front end part of the synthesis flow is common no matter what your actual target, implementation target is, but technology mapping will differ. So we will be discussing technology mapping for standard cell-based ASICs, right? A lot of these concepts are also applicable to other, in the other contexts, but you know, we'll be discussing it in the context of standard cell-based ASICs, where you have a standard cell library that is given to technology mapping. The way you should think of these two optimization phases is that technology independent optimization produces a good rough structure for the network, and technology mapping uses the optimal combination of cells available in your library to realize that structure. Okay. So what are the inputs and outputs of technology mapping? The input to technology mapping is a Boolean network, which has already been optimized using technology independent optimizations, something like this. And a cell library that contains cells or gates that can be used to realize this circuit, along with models. Now you need to be a little more accurate when you're trying to, you can't just use literal count anymore. So in order to be able to estimate the area, delay, and power consumption of the circuit after you map it, these cells in your library have to be characterized for those different metrics of interest, area, delay, and power consumption. So this might be your library. In this case, you know, you have gates with different numbers of inputs. Typically, you will also have gates with different drive strengths. In other words, the transistor sizes, they may have the same functions, for example, a two-input AND gate, but with different drive strengths. So the transistor sizes are going to be different, right? And needless to say, having a rich cell library goes a great way towards facilitating or increasing the scope of choices that technology mapping has, and therefore you can expect a better quality circuit to result at the end. So you want to have a library that is reasonably rich. Modern commercial libraries have, you know, several tens of cells at least, if not hundreds. Okay. So each of these cells has been characterized for area, delay, power. For example, you may take a transistor level netlist of the cell and perform SPICE simulation because it's a relatively small circuit, and you might be able to estimate its delay and power consumption from that simulation. And you might actually do a layout of the cell to estimate its area. So you have relatively accurate estimates from characterizing these cells. What you need to do now is, given the cell library, given this network, how do I break these functions down in terms of these cells and do this in a sort of optimal manner? Right. Here is a very simple example of a cell library. In addition to simple functions like, you know, OR, AND, NAND, and so on, you also should expect to see slightly more complex functions. For example, the OAI21 is a complex gate which implements a OAI, stands for OR AND invert. Okay. So that is, and the OAI211 is another example of a complex function. You could have multiplexers. You could have, you know, even simple arithmetic building blocks like full adders. And cells of that nature also as part of the cell library. As I said, commercial libraries have dozens, if not hundreds, of logic cells, of instances. Typically, each function is also provided in different drive strengths. The rationale being that on your critical parts of the circuit, you would like to use cells that are gates that are faster. So you'd use the higher drive strength versions of these gates. Whereas on the off-critical paths, you can use the slower ones, which are more area or power efficient. And again, just as I mentioned, richer cell libraries usually help you getting better quality circuits, while on the other hand, the complexity of technology mapping does increase. Okay. So it's important to come up with efficient algorithms to actually do the technology mapping, which is what we'll talk about. So if you look at the broad approaches that people have taken to technology mapping, they fall into a few different categories. The earliest technology mapping logic synthesis systems used rule-based technology mapping. So these were rather ad hoc tools that just codified insights that human designers may have, right? So for example, as a human designer, what you are inclined to do is, if you know the cells in your cell library, you visually inspect the expressions in the different nodes in the network and say, hey, that looks like a NAND, let me use a NAND, okay? So these are sort of ad hoc pattern matching rule-based approaches. And there was a new generation of synthesis tools that made this pattern matching a little more rigorous and said that, well, this is really a structural pattern matching problem where if you can represent your cell library as well as the circuit using some sort of a common representation, and you can identify which parts of the circuit correspond to each of these cells, if you can break both of these down in terms of some common representation, you can try to perform matching in terms of where you can use instances of the cell library. And eventually, it comes down to a problem where I have this large Boolean network, and I would like to take instances of the cell library and cover all the nodes in the network such that it is fully covered. So it becomes some sort of a covering problem, as we will see. Okay, but basically, a more systematic algorithmic approach. This was first introduced in Dagon, which was from AT&T Bell Labs, and also later implemented in MIS and SIS. Each node of the network is decomposed in order to realize or identify the matching in a systematic manner. Each node of your Boolean network is decomposed into primitive functions. For example, you can just use NAND gates to represent, as we know, you can use NAND gates to represent any logic function. So you can take the expressions inside each node of your Boolean network and decompose them just in terms of NANDs. And then you have a graph, instead of your original Boolean network with two-level expressions in each node, you decompose it into just a network of NAND gates. Similarly, your library, each of the cells in your library can also be, each of them is also a combinational function, so each of them can also be represented as a network of NAND gates. Now it becomes a pattern matching problem. I have a pattern of NAND gates for each cell in my library. Where does this pattern occur in my circuit? Okay. Of course, this set of primitive gates must be complete, and the example I gave you, NAND alone, is complete. But for convenience, typically in practice, people use two-input NANDs and inverters as well. So you don't have to tie the two inputs of a NAND gate together to realize an inverter. This is what is most commonly used in practice. Once you do this, the network, the Boolean network, once you decompose each of the nodes in terms of NAND gates, is typically referred to as a subject graph. And each gate of the cell library is also represented using the same set of primitive gates. And those are called pattern graphs. So now the problem boils down into taking the subject graph and superimposing pattern instances of the pattern graphs from your library, corresponding to your library, all over the subject graph. One problem does arise that the same function can be represented in multiple ways as, both in the subject graph and in the pattern graph. And the way this ambiguity is resolved is by looking at the cell library, because cells are usually smaller than the circuit you're trying to map, and taking each cell and representing it in all possible ways as networks of NAND gates. Okay. So to give you a simple example, if you have a 5-input AND, you can represent it as a balanced tree, or you can represent it as a linear chain. That's structurally, those two look very different, even though functionally they're the same. In order to ensure that you have matches identified whenever possible, as much as possible, you need to take each cell in your cell library and represent it in multiple ways, all possible ways, as networks of NAND gates, okay, NAND gates and inverters. And once you do that, it becomes a graph covering problem, where you're trying to cover the subject graph with pattern graphs. So this is a structural matching approach, which is largely used in commercial tools today. So today, most commonly in practice, structural pattern matching is the approach that is used. However, researchers also investigated more advanced techniques, Boolean matching, where you're actually exploiting Boolean relationships to find more or better matches. And here, rather than structurally representing the gates in the library as well as the circuit as subject and pattern graphs, you use functional canonical representations like BDDs, which are a little more powerful in being able to identify possible matches. Okay. However, as you can imagine, this is a little more computationally complex. So in practice, you know, structural matching is what is most often used in practice. And that's what we'll therefore focus on. Let's elaborate a little bit on the terms we just defined, and so that we can understand the overall structure of how structural pattern matching works. First step is to construct the subject graph. So you take each node of the Boolean network and decompose it into these primitive functions, the base functions, which in our case will be two input NAND and inverters. So this is an example. Start off with this Boolean network. Each of these nodes, you take its expression and express it in terms of two input NANDs and inverters. So if you look at D or E, that can be expressed in this way using two inverters and one two input NAND gate. If you look at node T2, similarly, it can be expressed in this way. Node T3 is this, node T4 and T5. Okay. So this is just a linear process. You take each of these nodes, expand it out into using two input NANDs and inverters and connect it together the way the connections are in the Boolean network. So construction of the subject graph is a relatively straightforward process. Subject graph is, assuming your circuit is not cyclic, is a directed acyclic graph. Okay. This process is not unique. Especially when you have more complex expressions, you can decompose them in multiple ways using two input NANDs and inverters. However, you don't worry about considering all possibilities here, because you're considering all possibilities in the cell library representation, right? So you don't need to do the work twice. So here, any one decomposition, you just pick any one arbitrarily, and it's fine. Okay. So this is a relatively straightforward process, and at the end of it, you have this large network of NAND gates and inverters. Now, you go to the cell library and try to construct the pattern graphs for each of the cells in the cell library. Each cell in the library is represented in terms of the same base functions, two input NAND and inverter, resulting in the pattern graphs. You know that the representation is not unique, so here you enumerate all possibilities. So you represent each gate in all possible ways. So here's one example for NAND 4. Here's other examples also which implement NAND 4. Right? So these are all multiple pattern graphs for the same function, for the four input NAND. All of these may correspond to the same cell in the library. So all of these, from an area delay power point of view, may actually have the same area delay power, right? But because you would like to identify in your subject graph, you don't know whether you're going to see, well, you definitely are not going to see this because you don't have four input NAND, four input, you only use two inputs, but you don't know whether you're going to see this or this in your actual subject graph. So you consider both possibilities here, okay? So if you look at a simple library, this is what it might look like. You have a cell or a pattern graph, which is in terms of the two input NAND gates and inverters, and you have a cost associated with it. The cost can represent delay, the cost can represent area, the cost can represent power, whatever metric you want to optimize. Okay. So in this case, you know, the NAND 2 with a cost of 2. Similarly, here's a bunch of other, it's a relatively simple library. So this is a NAND 3. NAND 4 is represented in two possible ways. Cost is, of course, the same, since it's the same cell. And or inverse 2-1, AOI 2-2, XOR, and NOR 3, NOR 4. So you'll see typically the larger gates have more ambiguity in how you represent them. So for example, the NOR 4 input gates are when you see some ambiguity. And you also have, like you had AND OR invert, you also have OR AND invert, 2-1 and 2-2, and XNOR. So this is a relatively simple library. You can expect to see something like this with SIS. And you will be doing technology mapping, so you can see something like this with SIS. Now, given this problem formulation, you have the subject graph and you have these set of pattern graphs corresponding to cells in the library. Now, this basically becomes a graph covering problem. It becomes a problem of tiling these pattern graphs onto the subject graph such that the subject graph is fully covered. Right? A cover is defined as a collection of pattern graph instances such that every node of the subject graph is contained in one or more of these instances. So you want the subject graph to be fully covered because you want to fully express your circuit in terms of the cell library. And each input required by a pattern graph instance is a primary input of your entire circuit or the output of some other pattern graph instance. We'll see in a minute what this means. This is a constraint because you cannot if this is your entire circuit, you cannot have these instances of the pattern. What you're trying to do is you're trying to create these pattern graphs to cover, kind of tile them to cover your original circuit, right? But you cannot have them overlapping in a arbitrary way. And you can't have these instances of pattern graphs overlapping with each other. And that's what this constraint really specifies, that if I have an instance of the pattern graph here, its inputs must be either available directly as primary inputs of the circuit, or they must be available as outputs of what other instance that I have. Right? So that is a well-formed, a well-structured covering. It requires that this be satisfied so that you can connect the instances, because it's not just about covering things. You need to be able to connect these things together in the appropriate way. And the only way you can connect them is that the outputs of either the primary inputs or the outputs of one of these can go to the inputs of the other ones. Okay. So that is the other constraint. And the objective function here is that you need to find the minimum cost cover. So for now, we will assume initially that the cost is additive. Not all cost functions or metrics are additive. Okay. Area is additive. Power is additive. Delay is not additive. Because delay depends on the longest path through your circuit. You don't add up the delays of all the gates in your circuit and call that your clock period. You take the longest path. So we know that this is not going to work for delay. We'll come back and see how delay is handled. But for now, to understand how technology mapping works, let's assume for simplicity that the cost is additive. So let's say in practice it means area or power, right? Both of those are additive. So here's the example subject graph that we just created. And here is one possible cover, right? Trivial cover. As long as you have a two-input NAND as a cell in your library, if you have inverter, you can take each two-input NAND and realize it, right? So this will always work. This is one solution. Why could this be a problem? Or why would you not want to do this? The cost is going to be large, right? This may not be optimal. So the cost of this cover, what is the cost of this cover? In this case, you just count how many two-input NANDs you have. There's 8 of them, 7 inverters. From your library, the models, you know what the cost of a single two-input NAND is, single inverter is. Plug it in here, you know the cost of this cover. Right? Of course, the reason this is an interesting problem computationally is because multiple solutions exist. Some of them are trivial, but to find the optimal solution is not that straightforward. So here is one alternative solution. Here, what you're saying, heuristically, you can say that I'm trying to use large cells, as large as possible. Because larger cells, in a sense, are typically more optimized. Right? The person who has implemented this as a transistor-level netlist or a complex CMOS gate has had more scope, for the designer has had more scope to optimize that. So if you use an AND or invert here at the output, then you can say that this is an AND gate, an AND followed by inverter. This is a two-input OR. Another two-input OR, two NAND, two-input NAND, inverter. This is another cover, right? So what is the cost of this cover? Just add up the cost of the individual ones, right? 4 plus 6 is 10, 15, 17, 18. The cost of this cover is 18. What was the cost of the previous cover, the trivial one we came up with? This was 23, right? So 8 into 2 plus 7 into 1, 23. So we did a little better than that, so we were able to get 18. Can we do even better? Right? This is one possible solution. Are there other solutions? So here the cost is, you know, 1 AOI to 22. You can just plug in all of the math and it works out to 18. Here's yet another solution. Here, counterintuitively, I'm actually using a smaller gate at the output. But that allows me to use a larger gate here in the middle. Okay? And I can make this an AND3, I can make this an OAI21, I can make this an OAI21, AND2 inverter. And what is the cost here? 3 threes are 9. 15, right? So, 23, 18, 15 seem to be going the right direction. The question is, you need a systematic approach to explore this design space. It's a pretty large design space. Okay. You can't always say that using larger cells is better, because if you look at the previous mapping with the cost of 18, we used a large cell here, but it prevented you from using larger cells in the middle of the network. So in practice, which of these combinations, it's a combinatorial problem, right? It's a selection problem. Which of these combinations is actually going to work out to be better? depends on the specific instances and the costs and how they add up. So it's a this is a complex optimization problem. So you need a systematic approach to explore this design space. So how do you actually go about doing that? The general approach is, of course, after you construct the subject graph for the Boolean network and represent each gate as pattern DAGs, general approach to finding an optimal cost covering of the subject DAG using the pattern DAGs, one of the issues is that the problem of doing this, complexity of covering optimally for a DAG in general, is NP-hard, right? It remains NP-hard even if all nodes in your subject and pattern graphs have in degree of less than equal to 2, which is true in our case, because we are only using 2 input ANDs and inverters, so graphs have incoming edges, only at most 2 incoming edges. But DAG covering is an NP-hard problem, inherently. So the optimal solution immediately goes out of the window, but there is two general approaches that are used. One is to formulate this graph covering problem as a table covering problem. And table covering problems are very familiar to us in design automation because, you know, we've looked at Espresso, we've looked at the 0-1 kernels, so we've beaten up this table covering to death, right? So can we transform this problem to something else that we know how to do efficiently? So one general approach to DAG covering is to transform it into a binate row covering problem, and we'll see exactly what that means in the next lecture. But the other possibility is to decompose this DAG into trees. It turns out that if your DAG is a tree, so what's the difference between a DAG and a tree? Both are acyclic, but why is what can you not have in a tree that you can have in a DAG? You can have fan out and reconvergence, right? You can have reconvergent fan out that you cannot have in a tree. If your structure of the circuit is a tree, it turns out that there is an optimal polynomial time complexity algorithm, very efficient algorithm using dynamic programming, which we'll again explain in detail, that can be used to optimally map your circuit. Okay? So another solution approach, which actually is the more commonly used in practice, is to decompose the DAG into trees, and for each tree, you come up with an optimal, use the polynomial time optimal algorithm tree-wise. It's optimal for the individual trees, not optimal for the whole circuit as a whole, but that's okay. I mean, the problem is NP-hard, so you know that you're not going to come up with an efficient and optimal algorithm. You have to take the hit somewhere. So in the next lecture, we'll go into each of these approaches in turn and discuss how it works, okay, how you solve this problem. Any questions thus far on the overall formulation of technology mapping? Okay, thank you.